The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the simplest, most powerful website creator that helps you make headlines with your own stunning online presence. Explore elegant templates, Getty image integration, and more at squarespace.com and use the code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Hannah Devlin. Coming up on the show, self-confessed sceptical environmentalist Bjorn Lomborg gives us his take on climate change. He believes the 2-degree global warming target wasn't well thought out, that fracking is a useful short-term solution to cutting emissions, and that the money spent used to subsidise wind and solar would be better spent developing radical new green energy sources. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Bjorn Lomborg, the Danish author and political scientist, is best known for his 2001 book, The Sceptical Environmentalist, in which he controversially claims that overpopulation, declining energy resources, species loss, and certain aspects of global warming are unsupported by the evidence. Lomborg isn't a sceptic in the climate change denial sense. His stance is more that man-made global warming is real, it just isn't the end of the world. Lomborg spoke to The Guardian's Keep It In The Ground project recently about the economics of climate change, emissions targets, fracking and green energy. This week we're going to take a closer look at some of his arguments and ask whether the gap is narrowing between what has sometimes felt like two deeply entrenched sides in the climate debate. I'm joined down the line by Dr. Chris Hope, a climate policy researcher at Cambridge Judge Business School, and in the studio by Mark Maslin, Professor of Climatology at University College London, and Adam Vaughan, editor of The Guardian's environment site. Welcome to you all.
Hello.
Hi.
Here's what Bjorn Lomborg had to say when we spoke to him.
Well, I think we need to step a little bit back. It's very true that climate change is real. It's man-made. It is a problem that we need to tackle. But we also got to ask ourselves, how much is it going to cost and how much is it going to cost not to tackle it? Cutting CO2 is going to be costly. And so we need to compare what is the cost of cutting CO2 with what are the benefits of cutting CO2. Now, remember, there's a lot of people who will tend to say, oh, the cost of action is perhaps 1% or 2%, whereas the cost of inaction, the not doing anything about climate, is perhaps even greater. But we have to remember that's a false way to present the problem, because we're not actually fixing climate change with our current climate policies. We're slightly reducing the problem. So the real question is, how much are we cutting the terms of problem compared to how much are we spending? And that's where the real problem lies, namely the current climate policies are simply phenomenally expensive, and yet they do very little to cut carbon emissions. Right now, most of climate policies are about subsidizing existing inefficient solar panels and wind turbines. It makes us feel good. It makes a lot of rich people feel like they're doing something about climate change. But in reality, it has almost no impact on the climate.
Chris, I'd like to just first come to the idea that most of what we're spending our money on in terms of climate policy are subsidies at the moment. Is that correct?
Subsidies are one of the weapons that people have used, and they've used it because we haven't been able to agree as a society to use what is obviously the best way of having a first go at dealing with the climate change problem, which is to make those energy sources that emit greenhouse gases more expensive by putting on a climate change tax on burning of coal and oil and gas in proportion to the amount of carbon dioxide that's emitted by them. And the level of the climate change tax, the model suggests, should be round about $120 or £75 per tonne of carbon dioxide. And that is by far the most sensible first step that we should be taking in order to try and tackle this really serious problem.
I'd also like to address the point that wind and solar are fundamentally inefficient technologies and that we're wasting a lot of money on them just to make ourselves feel as though we're doing something. How do wind and solar really compare to other energies at the moment? Maybe if Mark could come back on that one.
So I think the fundamental problem here is that at the moment, people perceive that wind, solar, tidal are more expensive than fossil fuels. But this is because of subsidies. So the fossil fuel industry gains, I think it's $5.6 trillion of subsidies every year. And that's according to the IMF. Now, that's twice the GDP of the UK every single year. It's also more than actually all the countries in the world spend together on health. So if you imagine taking those subsidies from fossil fuels and shifting them straight away, instantaneously into renewables, suddenly renewables would A, be incredibly cheap compared with fossil fuels, and secondly, the innovation that would go on would be incredibly rapid because there'll be huge profits to be made by those companies.
And when you're talking about fossil fuels being subsidised, are you talking about state-owned fossil fuel companies? Is that what you mean by that?
Well, the problem is that the way the IMF looked at it is the subsidies actually cross a huge plethora of government aid. And the problem is that we can't move those subsidies very quickly, because if you look at the largest 25 companies in the world who look after fossil fuels, 18 of them are partially or fully owned by a government. And of course, those governments can give backhanders, they can give subsidies, tax breaks, or just not charge tax. And so those subsidies together are huge. Now, if we could actually change that and perhaps have, say, renewable energy companies, state-owned, then, of course, you could see that working very well. And that's what we have to do. We have an infrastructure change to actually change our carbon-rich lifestyle.
Of the $5.6 trillion US dollars that's being given effectively in subsidies to fossil fuel companies, about $1.2 trillion is just explicitly because they are not being made to pay for the climate change damage that they are causing. So if we look at that kind of scale of subsidy, then indeed it's nowhere near a level playing field at the moment. And if we were to charge those companies or the users of fossil fuels the amount of damage that's being caused by the use of those fuels, then we would see a lot of other energy sources would suddenly become cheaper than those fossil fuels.
Obviously, it's not just a pure physics problem, it is a problem of economics as well. But is there a way of trying to set aside the subsidies and look at which things really pay for themselves if you separate out the different types of energy?
One of the wonderful things about using a climate change tax is that it allows every single person who has to make a decision about where they're going to live, whether they're going to drive or cycle, what energy they're going to use to provide electricity in their home. Every one of them makes the decision based on the real costs of those fuels that they're facing. So if fossil fuels were facing a climate change tax of the order of £75 per tonne of carbon dioxide, suddenly people don't need to be racked with guilt about the energy choices they're making. They just need to now look around and see what's going to be the cheapest source of electricity for them. And it's more likely to be a renewable energy source, or even at some point in the future, a nuclear powered system, than it is to be a fossil fuel powered one. And similarly, when they make decisions in the longer term about where they're going to live and how they're going to arrange their lives, they may well decide that it makes more sense to arrange their lives in a way that they're not going to have to drive huge distances to get to either their work or other places they want to be, but they're going to be able to either use public transport or cycle, because that will be a cheaper thing to do.
I mean, Lomborg's clearly right on one thing. I mean, you know, the amount of sort of solar and wind, even though we've been installing it in record rates over the last few years globally, you know, it's not shifted the dial, as it were, on our efforts to tackle climate change, because population is increasing and energy demand globally is increasing. But, you know, you have to take issue with the stereotyping of renewable energy sources as inefficient. I don't know if he's talking about financially or on some sort of technical level there, but I mean, branding of renewables as intermittent and unreliable is very much a, you know, vested interest lobbying campaign that we've seen. You know, we have seen that sort of lobbying going on from vested interests in fossil fuel sector, and you know, the UK gets between 10% and 20% of its electricity from renewables now, depending on how much the wind's blowing. And, you know, several European countries are getting towards sort of the halfway mark, you know, getting half of their electricity. So there's certainly a conversation to be had about the most efficient cost way to do it, but to fund those. But I think the idea that, you know, these technologies are not at work seems to be quite lazy from him, I think. From, you know, I'm surprised he does that.
It's an interesting point, Adam, and I wanted to ask about that, because part of the idea of subsidies is that it'll help innovation and help drive improvements in technologies, but there's sometimes been criticisms that that's not always happened, and that there's almost a complacency that if you know you can get something subsidised, you can put up a load of solar panels on rooftops, even if it's not helpful. How much have these technologies improved since we've started subsidising them? If you look at solar, for example,
Well, one of the interesting things on wind is there's always wind farms in the UK where they're taking down the initial turbines they put up because, you know, you're now getting, you know, the sort of 3 megawatt turbines of old, and now, you know, and there's new ones coming through that are 6 megawatts, and, you know, and practically twice the size. And, you know, that is already, it's already economic for developers to take down existing wind farms and put up much bigger ones so they get more bang for their buck. And solar panels, the efficiency stuff has certainly been going up, but the main change there has been cost. If certainly as a householder, for example, in the UK, if you bought solar panels for your house today, they'd be about half the cost as what they were about 5 years ago. And so and to be fair, the subsidies have come down to reflect that. You know, there have been, you know, very rapid changes, if not on the technology, then the cost side.
If you track, say, solar panels and the cost and the efficiency, you see that whenever a country has put in a program such as Japan and then Germany, and they put in a program of subsidies and driving, it does drive innovation. You see that the actual efficiency jumps up, the cost drops, and this occurs again and again and again. And we also know that subsidies work from other fuel industries. So we know from the North Sea, the oil companies did not want to go into the North Sea because it's a horrible place to work. You have hurricane-like conditions for 3 months of the year. But the UK government pushed subsidies, tax breaks in the 70s to actually try to encourage the North Sea oil industry. And guess what? It worked. We have fantastic oil reserves and natural gas there that are actually taken out of the ground incredibly safely. But that was driven by UK and European subsidies.
It's a great mistake to get fixated on one or two technologies. If you look at the kind of work that's been done by people like McKinsey, they have looked at over 50 technologies that can contribute to cutting back emissions of carbon dioxide. And they've laid them out according to how much it would cost to cut back carbon dioxide with each of these technologies. And what they've found is that we can cut back almost 100% of the carbon dioxide emitted around the world by using these whole range of technologies, from switching lighting from incandescent to LEDs to better efficiency in houses to using solar power, using penetration of wind where it's most effective, up to retrofitting of carbon capture and storage and nuclear power stations. We can cut back essentially all the CO2 emitted around the world at a cost of less than about £70 per tonne of carbon dioxide. So if we were to put on a climate change tax equal to about £75 per tonne of carbon dioxide, which is what we should be putting on because that's the best estimate of the damage being caused by these fossil fuels, then we would essentially see people just making their decisions in all areas of their life, moving towards the lower carbon sources of energy, moving towards lower carbon ways of living, and we will be enormously effective at cutting back our emissions of carbon dioxide. And this is not me saying this, and it's not some sandal-wearing hippie saying this. This is McKinsey saying this, and have produced really quite good marginal abatement cost curves showing those kinds of options that can add up to very significant cutbacks in carbon dioxide emissions.
Here's Bjorn Lomberg again.
The US has, over the last 30 years or so, spent about $10 billion making fracking, or making the shale gas revolution, happen. Now, there's a lot of controversy about that, but let's just remember shale gas, or gas in general, probably emits about half as much CO2 as coal. And because shale gas has gotten much cheaper in the US, they've actually switched 6 or 7 percentage points of their electricity production from coal to gas. Now, that means that the US has probably cut its carbon emissions about 3 times as much as all the wind turbines and solar panels in Europe. That's because they have made shale gas so cheap, everyone wants it. And so the US is probably making money. One estimate shows that they're making about $300 billion every year by having cheaper shale gas available. And they're cutting 3 times as much CO2. Compare that to Europe, that's only cutting 1/3 of the CO2. And we are paying about $40 billion for that privilege.
So I think shale gas is a really interesting one. It's obviously better than coal. And Lomborg is taking that and saying, well, it's therefore a good option. It's a good bridge between what we have now and a lower carbon future. Yet despite this, it's been met with a lot of opposition in this country and elsewhere, the idea that we should be shifting towards shale gas. And I wonder whether that's justified or whether that's just people looking at shale gas and thinking it's a fossil fuel, Greenpeace don't like it, I feel like I shouldn't like it either. I'd just like to ask a bit about whether Lomborg's right on this or whether there are valid reasons to be cautious about moving towards a shale gas energy balance.
So there seems to be, again, an obsession here with one or two technologies and comparing them with one other technology, which isn't necessarily the right way forward. But just to take the argument on its own basis about shale gas and how effective that is at cutting back emissions. Shale gas is indeed emits less carbon dioxide when it's burnt than does coal. But in order to get the shale gas out of the ground, you have to do some fairly complicated processes under the ground. What has been found is that those complicated processes mean that you don't always capture all of the methane, which is what the shale gas is, in the system that you're setting up. Some of it escapes into the atmosphere. And methane is a very potent greenhouse gas. It's probably 20 or more times as potent as carbon dioxide on a molecule-for-molecule basis. So what people have found is that with the emissions of this fugitive methane that you're not capturing, you can end up, if you're in a well which is really not that effective at capturing the methane, having a worse effect on the climate than if you were burning coal. But it's certainly true that if you have the better wells that are emitting less of this fugitive methane, then there is some benefit from having shale gas as opposed to burning coal.
I think one of the things we have to do when we talk about climate change is we have to put it in its context of the 21st century and the challenges we face. And we do face climate change, but we also have problems of global poverty, environmental degradation, and of course, global security. So each country then has to make a choice about their energy mix, which actually tries to actually address all of those four major problems. So shale gas is a wonderful geopolitical tool because it allows the US to be self-reliant on its energy mix and therefore not import oil or natural gas. So again, that's a wonderful political choice that they've made. However, when it comes to climate change, you then have to look at how much does that mixture actually make. Now, we all agree that actually coal-fired power stations are incredibly inefficient when it comes to the amount of energy you get for the amount of CO2. So anything we can do in the short term to actually remove those from the energy mix will be a positive thing. But what we should do is convert power stations to natural gas and to shale gas from coal, but not to build new ones. Because if we need new ones, then we should be building renewable energy and looking for different sources. So shale gas is a great short-term intermediate step that allows us to get away from coal, but it is not the solution when we actually need to actually have reduced our emissions globally to zero by about 2070.
And technically, can you do that? Because, I mean, this is really the key thing, that shale gas is something that's really in the ascendancy. The question is partly whether it's really possible to directly replace coal with shale gas.
So what you find is power stations in the UK and through Europe and the rest of the world are very good at monitoring the cost of their fuel. And so therefore, something like Drax Power Station will actually look at whether they want to have wood pellets, coal, or gas as a major fuel source to basically, it's steam power. We're back in the steam age. And all they're doing is driving turbines by superheating water. So that's all they're doing in a power station. So again, what they'll do is they'll look at the international markets and work out which gives them the biggest profit. Is it using cheap coal? Is it using shale gas? Is it using wood pellets from a renewable source? And that's based on the subsidies, the level on the international markets per cost. And so therefore, if you actually then build in the carbon emissions into that, as the European trading scheme does, then that actually helps push these power stations towards greener and less carbon-rich fuels.
Adam, having reported on this issue, do you think there is sometimes a bit of a knee-jerk response from environmental groups just anti-shale because it's a fossil fuel without really thinking about what useful role it might play?
Well, I mean, it's worth saying that, I mean, the Greens are divided on this. You know, the main groups in the UK are WWFs and the Friends of the Earths and Greenpeaces and the like. They are against it, and it is partly ideologically driven in the same way that their opposition is to nuclear. They know that on a local level, this works people up. You know, this gets together the crusties and the generals and unites them on, you know, really simple, you know, the fear over water pollution, whether, you know, rightly or wrongly, you know, really inarguable stuff like a lot of hairy lorries coming into what are quite often relatively quiet rural areas and other, you know, issues about flaring at night and things like that. Also, obviously, there are the broader climate change concerns. So you can sort of see why they've got behind it. But there is other people, you know, people at LSE and other people in other camps where people who you would consider Greens who are saying this is a bridge to a greener future in the meantime. I mean, the interesting thing about Longborg's argument about, you know, the US has done much better on emissions than Europe by doing shale rather than renewables. I mean, yes is the answer, but only if you look at things in a very parochial sense. I mean, although the American coal industry, which we've reported on very closely, has been declining, although they're losing power stations, they're still exporting all that. What his analysis sort of misses, willfully or not, I don't know, is the fact that coal is all still going elsewhere. And that's the pertinent issue, I guess, in the UK. I mean, we know now we've got a Tory majority government, you know, that they're going to be going all out, as they've said, for shale. I think the question here is going to be whether that may well displace some of our coal use, although most of the reports, people like the UK Energy Research Centre and others have said the quantities aren't going to be that big here to change things. But, you know, does it just mean that we import some less gas from Qatar or we use some less coal, but that's going to go elsewhere? You know, there's a big Paris climate conference at the end of the year, but no one is expecting that to have some sort of carbon cap. You know, countries are going to put forward their carbon targets, but there's not going to be some sort of overall carbon cap that means somehow that gas or that coal doesn't get used elsewhere. So, I mean, that is partly the problem, Michelle. I guess you can sort of see environmentalists' opposition to it, that you're just adding to the resource of fossil fuels.
Back to Bjorn Lomborg.
When people say, for instance, that we're going to see declines in output of wheat, corn and rice, the three major staples from the world, it's true that higher temperatures, if we don't adapt, and if we don't take into account that CO2 is also a fertilizer, we are going to see declines in production yield increases. Remember, it's only in the increases, not the actual level. But the reality is, of course, farmers will and have adapted, and they will also actually exploit the fact that CO2 acts as a fertilizer, which probably means that overall, right now, we have seen dramatic increases in food production, and part of that may actually be because of CO2. Now, in the long run, yes, global warming and CO2 increases are going to cause problems. But I also think we need to have the audacity to actually dare believe in what the UN climate panel tells us more than we just think, well, I've read in the paper, so clearly it must be a big problem.
So, Mark, maybe I can come to you with this one. The idea that we're not sure that global warming is going to be bad for food production. So the idea is we're balancing the greater risk of droughts and hot temperatures that maybe crops aren't well designed to cope with, against the idea that CO2 itself is a fertilizer, so that plants convert sunlight and CO2 into energy and perhaps can grow more efficiently if there's more CO2 in the atmosphere. Is that likely to happen? Might there be areas which do better off in a higher CO2 world?
So the fundamental problem with Longberg's argument is that he sees agriculture from a very European and American-centric view, which is you have huge industrial farms, you have lots and lots of tractors, and you basically produce food on an industrial scale. Most of the world does not work like this. Most of the world has undergone the Green Revolution of the 1960s and 70s, particularly in Latin America and Southeast Asia. And it's been incredibly successful that you have small farmers who are producing food, and most of the time they are actually physically working on the land to produce that food. So the interesting thing is, when we look at climate change, these individuals are not protected against droughts. If the heat waves start to occur, you have to remember in the tropics, there is a physiological limit to the temperatures you can actually work outside. And so what you see in the models is those poor small farmers who are actually feeding half the world's population, their productivity, their physical productivity, and the productivity of the ground actually diminishes over the next 50 to 70 years. And that's important. Yes, if we have industrialized agriculture across the whole world, we can balance out poor climate with extra fertilizer, with extra irrigation. But the world doesn't work like that. And it really upsets me that Longberg forgets that about 3.5 billion people live on less than about $3.50 a day.
So you're saying essentially, even if we just shift crops around to grow where they're best suited, people aren't going to necessarily be able to buy those if they're being grown outside of their own areas where they live.
Well, if we look at the past, the big problem is when we have famine and we have a lack of food is not because there's a lack of food in the world. We have enough food to feed everybody. And it's usually not a lack of food in that area. It is a lack of money. So the small farm holders, if they have a crop that fails, they have no money. So they can't buy food, they starve. And so what we come to a point is it's not about climate and agriculture, it's about money and where people have money to actually be able to buy food. So I always use the example, if suddenly all the crops in the UK failed due to climate change and for 1 year we didn't actually have any food produced in this country, yeah, we'll just buy it. We'll just buy it on the international markets and that will be fine. But most of the world does not work like that, and they don't have those resources.
Even on Lomborg's argument taken at face value, I think there's a lot of researchers who would disagree that any kind of fertilisation you get from higher CO2 will get any way to balancing out the losses in agriculture that we would see from higher temperatures. So people like David Battisti at the University of Washington in the US has done studies of the four main bread baskets in the world and the kinds of changes in yield that we would expect to see, even taking into account fertilisation of CO2 when you get increases in temperature. And he finds that we will probably get losses of 10 to 15% of yield for every 1 degree that the temperature goes up in those bread baskets. And don't forget that if we carry on emitting carbon dioxide as we are doing, then we're likely to see temperature rises of maybe 4 degrees or even higher by the end of the century. And we've got studies by people like Matt Huber at the University of New Hampshire, who is very good at finding out just when it becomes impossible for people to do hard physical work. There's been lots of studies showing that if the wet bulb globe temperature goes above about 31 degrees, it becomes impossible for people to carry on doing hard physical work. And if it goes above 34 degrees, then it becomes almost impossible just to sit outside and survive. And we are looking at a world 50 or 100 years down the line where many more countries and many more regions are going to be facing those kind of wet bulb globe temperatures. And therefore, it will become much harder to be able to produce food out in the open just because it will be physically impossible to do the work that's required.
Here's Bjorn Lomborg again.
No political entity that I can think of are behaving anywhere as if they actually believe they're going to fulfill the 2-degree target. In that sense, it's simply a wishful thinking target. I think it's also important to recognize that the 2-degree target is not very well researched. There's one, as I can tell, one peer-reviewed paper on how did the 2-degree target actually end up being accepted. And the summary, and I'm quoting from that summary, says, "This target is supported by rather thin arguments based on inadequate methods, sloppy reasoning, and selective citation from a very narrow set of studies. Overall," it concludes, "the 2-degree target seems unfounded." And so I think we need, again, to recognize the 2-degree target is simply something people say. Nobody behaves as if they're going to do it. Certainly, we're not going to leave 3/4 of or 4/5 of all our fossil fuels in the grounds unless we find cheaper green energy.
Leaving aside for a second the question of whether we're going to meet the 2-degree target, I want to look at that question of where it came from and whether it's ill-founded, whether it's, it was just essentially plucked from thin air, as Lomborg seems to suggest. Mark, maybe you've got some thoughts.
I have to say the 2-degree limit has a wonderful history. So back in 2005, when Tony Blair was chair of the G8 and was also the chair of the EU, he wanted to have some sort of science to actually then push his climate change agenda. So he organised the Met Office to have an international meeting organised by the Tyndale Centre at Exeter. And there they actually discussed what is dangerous climate change. Lots of wonderful presentations. And slipping in there was the myth about agriculture. So there was a lot of studies early on that suggested up to 2 degrees, the temperate regions, North America, Russia, would actually benefit from longer, warmer summers, and therefore perhaps their agriculture would flourish and improve production. As we've discussed, subsequent studies suggest that these were inaccurate and wrong. And so what was found was about 2 degrees, everybody starts to lose. And this became sort of a mantra that Tony Blair took with him to the G8. And it's in the Glen Eagles memorandum of understanding with George Bush that the 2 degrees Celsius is discussed and mentioned. And then it has brought on a life of its own. But what it says is that there is climate change effects from now onwards, and we're already seeing them. And 2 degrees seems to be a point whereby we really don't want to go beyond. And it has a wonderful resonance that allows scientists to communicate with politicians about the immensity of the actual problem that they face.
So it does sound as though, just scientifically, it was almost a bit of a back of the envelope calculation that gave rise to the 2 degrees. But do you think we've got it about right, having stuck to that and it being the figure that we always talk about?
Well, I think this came up a bit last year when there was a high profile paper in Nature by a guy called David Victor in the States, and he was sort of basically saying, well, we're not really going to get to 2C, so why don't we junk it and replace it with it was a kind of like, here's something nice and simple, and we suggest replacing it with something much more complex, some suite of indicators of the planet's health. I spoke to a lot of people for reporting a piece on that, and I think what people were stressing was that, by and large, it's a political target. It's a something simple. I mean, I was talking to Angela Merkel's climate advisor, and he's explaining it's something simple that I was able to explain to heads of state, and that's what it's about. And also, I think the thing is even if a lot of scientists would say you need to go a lot lower than that to avoid, you know, that's, and you then get into issues of probability of you know, the risk, the likelihood of going over it as well. So, you know, a lot of people would, and a lot of small island states, for example, would say, you know, it should be 1.5 degrees, and if we get to 2, then we're wiped off the map, and, you know, it's too risky. But the reality is a political thing, and the reality is this is what governments have agreed, you know, in 2009 at Copenhagen to hold temperatures to. That's how all the pledges that are going to be submitted ahead of Paris will be marked against, about whether that, you know, and they won't add up to 2 degrees, but, you know, so I think it misses the point that it's largely actually a political target, not a scientific one.
The first thing to say is that 2 degrees is a nice target for getting people interested in the topic and for trying to move towards political action. But actually, scientifically, we don't have any idea of how many emissions we were allowed to put into the atmosphere in order to hit 2 degrees. There's a great deal of uncertainty around the climate sensitivity, just how much the temperature will go up if we put more emissions into the atmosphere. So the very best we could do would be to say, perhaps the target should be, well, we would try and aim for a 50% chance of staying below 2 degrees or a 30% chance of staying below 2 degrees. Now, of course, that has much less political resonance than saying our target is 2 degrees, but it's more honest. We don't want to be going down a route of being dishonest and lying to either politicians or the public and saying we're much more certain about this problem than we really are.
The most important way to fix climate change is to dramatically increase research and development into green energy. We propose, together with three Nobel laureates and 28 of the world's top climate economists, that it should be about 10 times what we spend today, so about $100 billion in research and development in green energy. That would allow us to spend money on a large number of different opportunities. We don't know which one will actually come through, but if we could make wind, solar, second generation biofuels, and all the other amazing ideas people have much cheaper. One of these technologies will undoubtedly be able to break through and actually become cheaper than fossil fuels. And then, of course, we will have solved global warming. So the reality is it's probably going to be a solution either from fusion of fission or from more energy efficiency or some of the more wild assumptions. For instance, Craig Venter, the guy who cracked the human genome back in 2000, he's now trying to make an algae that essentially produces oil on the ocean, just simply by sucking up sun from on the ocean surface and then transforming it into oil.
Now, Mark, this sounds quite positive. The idea of spending 10 times as much money on basic research as a blue skies researcher yourself, is that something that you'd welcome?
Of course, I'd always welcome more money in research. However, I think Bjørn Lomborg misses the whole point of geopolitics because he's saying, well, we have to make renewables cheaper than fossil fuels. However, if you happen to be the Saudi government and you decide to ratchet up production to bring down the oil price from $100 per barrel down to $40 per barrel, oh, which they've just done, then you can see that actually trying to invent Nirvana, where suddenly a new technology comes across that can actually beat that, all that will happen is then you can play the geopolitical game and you can then ratchet the price of oil down again and again. Now, for me, the key thing here is if you can move some of the trillions of dollars that are spent in fossil fuel subsidies and you move them across the line into renewables, then I'm talking about 10 to 100 times the amount of money that Bjørn Lomborg is looking at to actually boost renewables. Again, as per usual, he has a very small scale look at the world and actually uses very small numbers to change the world. Whereas actually we're talking about trillions of dollars floating around in subsidies that we could use for other purposes.
It also ignores, I mean, two key things, one of which is a sort of mandate. I mean, you know, where's the taxpayer that's going to go, yee-haw, you know, charge me 10 times as much for R&D on, you know, and you just look at what the debate is like around household energy bills for relatively small subsidies on renewable energy. And the other thing is, which is goes without saying, or what should go without saying, is the timescale. I mean, you know, the UK's climate advisors say, oh, electricity sector needs to be less than 50 grams of CO2 a megawatt hour by 2030. And, you know, so effectively decarbonised by 2030. So it's 15 years. So, you know, Bjorn would have us all embark on, you know, building a load of new campuses and kitting out a load of loose stuff to try and get the efficiency of solar cells. And I think it also views things wrong. It's missing the issue here. So my point being, you know, 15 years is, we've got that's the sort of time it takes to roll out this infrastructure, let alone, you know, go away and research it and then build it. But I mean, it also just misses the fact that this is not really a technology problem. This is a political problem, you know, witness what the Conservatives have just done with onshore wind in the UK. You know, they have it's the cheapest form of renewable energy in UK. Welsh and Scottish devolved administrations are already saying they want to keep the subsidies for it. But, you know, Tory MPs in the Shires, they see it as a vote winner to say we're going to... So it just misses the point. It's not about technology. It's about politics and money.
Yeah, this is an issue about politics, about science and about economics. And the great danger of saying that we can put a lot more money into R&D is that you end up then saying, oh, but we must wait until R&D has borne fruit before we can do anything about the problem. And if you look at the technologies that McKinsey put into their abatement cost curves, nearly all of them are technologies that exist today. They're things like making sure that motors run more efficiently, making sure that we have good energy efficiency in new buildings, making sure that we manage our grasslands well, making sure that the wind power that we have and that we know how to build is put in the right places. Nearly all of the reduction in CO2 that we would expect to see by 2030 or even 2050 is going to come from technologies that exist today. And all we need to do in order to reduce the great potential for that kind of new technology is to put on this climate change tax of £75 or so per tonne of CO2. And incidentally, I mean, this sounds horrible to people. It sounds like medicine because it sounds as though you're going to make everything much more expensive. But in fact, you're not, because the government then gets £60 billion worth of extra revenue from this climate change tax. And it can do things like reducing income taxes down from 20% to 15%, reducing VAT from 20% to 15%, and still have £10 billion a year left over for making sure that you're protecting the poor and the vulnerable and pensioners who might be affected by price rises. So people will actually win, the average household will win from this. It's a milkshake, not medicine. You end up getting back in these lower taxes, VAT, lower income taxes, more than you're having to pay in the extra costs of the fossil fuels. And it gives you this huge incentive to switch across in many, many ways that we know we can do already to different kinds of technologies, without it being a huge new R&D programme to make that happen, or without there having to be huge government regulations to make that happen. People will just switch over to these greener technologies, because once we charge fossil fuels the true cost of using them, then these green technologies end up being cheaper than using the fossil fuels.
I wanted now to just ask a more general question. Mark, I remember chairing a debate that you took part in about 5 years ago, and you were on the climate science side, and then there were loads of sceptics sending in questions who were almost universally against the science, who were saying that the science is wrong. Now, it feels like the debate's moved on a bit since then, and it's moved more towards the kinds of arguments that Lomborg is making, that the science isn't necessarily wrong, but there were questions about how worried we should be about it and what we should do about it. And I'm wondering whether you feel as though the debate's become more mature, and whether the discussions we're having today are more productive ones than they were maybe at the time of Copenhagen.
I think two things have gone on. The first thing is that you can see in Europe and the UK, there is a much more mature debate going on. However, there is still a hardcore of climate sceptics who will use any political tool they can to undermine climate scientists or politicians who support action on climate change. And we know that's happening. In the US, it's even worse. In the US, it is climate wars. And you find that the Senate has recently declared that, of course, that climate change is not man-made. And so we are a long way away from actually having a new debate. And I think the reason why people think that perhaps the debate has moved on is because what happened after Copenhagen and the financial crash was that climate change went off the agenda. When people are just worried about having jobs, whether they actually have enough money in the economy to actually make the economy even work, climate change becomes a luxury, and therefore for about 4 or 5 years just disappeared off the agenda. And it's only now, with the coming up of Paris and the realization that we are now coming out of our financial problems, that we can now address some of these more global issues that we need to deal with. So I'm not convinced that the actual debate has moved on as far as we would love to have seen.
I'd be interested in what you make of this point, Adam, having been at the centre of...
It's an interesting one. I mean, certainly in terms of on our blogs, so thinking of the sort of debunking and takedowns of climate sceptics that we've had, it's certainly, we are, the focus is more on the kind of, is definitely on the sort of people who are arguing the sort of like higher stage of climate denial, as it were, you know, where it's around the response and it's around the economics or the public policy, rather than as it was before, you know, just straightforward like Inhofer, climate, global warming is a hoax, man-made, you know.
And there are reasonable arguments to be had around that.
There are, and I mean, it's progress of a sort, but I think the problem is you look at the agenda and the background of a lot of the people who are pushing those arguments, and you realise it's actually just a more sophisticated version of the muddying the waters that came before. Mm. But there are, in some places, yes, it has led to some trend, but by and large, it's the same thing in new clothes, really, in many quarters when you look at where it's coming from and who's funding it. It's the same sort of muddying the waters on climate science and creating uncertainty where they're, you know, if you can think at the set in the interim, you know, we've had the IPCC, you know, saying that we've gone from 90% certainty to 95% certainty that it's, you know, man-made, and all the literature that's come in the meantime, you know, it seems odd that we are still slightly stuck on that debate. I mean, it's moved on a bit, but yeah, when you look at who's saying it, it's still largely the same people.
people's views on climate change are not about the weight of evidence. It's not about the science. It's about their fundamental belief system. And so somebody's politics will actually define whether they are accepting of the science, whether they're dubious about it, or whether they are outright deniers and say, actually, they're just making it up. And so the problem that we have is that we are challenging people's political viewpoints. Because the big problem with a global environmental issue such as climate change is it challenges the narrative of the last 35 years. So the last 35 years, neoliberalism has taken hold in much of the Anglo world and has driven politics. And therefore, that's about small government, individuals, markets are correct, low taxation. And suddenly you have a global problem that has to have regulation, taxation, as Chris is suggesting. We have to actually work collectively. We can't trust markets to sort it out because they're the ones that got into the first place. And so what you have is an environmental problem that is challenging the classical economics of the last 35 years. And you wonder why us climate scientists get it in the neck.
One of the things I've been really encouraged by over the last couple of years is that there have been people who are probably libertarians, really, in the US, but certainly in the Republican Party and maybe towards the right of that, who are putting forward the case that indeed the correct right-wing way to deal with this problem is to correct the markets, to make sure that fuels do pay their full costs. And if the fuels are causing problems, then they should be charged for the problems that they're causing. And that is beginning to get a little bit of traction, particularly amongst younger people in the Republican Party in the US. So we shouldn't tar everybody with the same brush.
Well, that feels like a positive note to end on, and it's all we've got time for this week. A big thank you to Bjorn Lomborg, Chris Hope, Mark Maslin and Adam Vaughan. From me, Hannah Devlin, and all at the Science team, thanks for listening.
Guardian listeners get the latest news, but they can also create it. With our sponsor Squarespace, you can easily create an elegant website for your personal brand, online store, business, personal portfolio, or blog. Whoever you are, Squarespace's simple tools and elegant designs make your ideas newsworthy and accessible to any audience. Try it at squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.